Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. You can probably count on the fingers of one hand the number of music groups that have lasted for four decades. And in fact, there is only one music duo that has had top 40 titles on the Billboard 200 in every decade from the 1980s to the 2010s, the Indigo Girls. And as the top 40 DJs used to say, the hits just keep on coming. The Indigo Girls keep having musical moments after all of this time together. One of their songs was featured in last summer's blockbuster movie Barbie. They are the subject of a documentary about their legacy, which was released last year, and their music will be the backdrop of a new jukebox musical romance film, Glitter and Doom. As part of their It's Only Life After All tour, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers are revisiting their roots in a way. Amy's brother Larry is a Davidson College alum, and their longtime manager Russell Carter got his start writing concert and album reviews for the Davidsonian. And now the Indigo Girls are returning to the Davidson campus to screen their film and perform at the new Davidson College Stadium. And in advance of that, we welcome them to our program for the hour. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
You know, this is remarkable. It really is remarkable. I don't know how you view it, but 40 years is a long time. Looking back to the very beginnings of all this, I'm not sure which one should answer this, so you take a pick. Did you ever imagine that this would go on this long?
No, I think, you know, when we were kids, we were, you know, in high school, we were 16 years old, and I think I was 15 and Emily was 16, and it was just getting together for fun and, you know, our friends around, and we loved music, we loved singing together. We had an English teacher that really influenced us and supported us, and, you know, our siblings went to school together, and we lived in neighborhoods that were adjacent to each other, and so I think it was just like the fun of, you know, neighborhood and school life. And, you know, we basically took it a day at a time and had very small goals. And that's kind of how we are now. You know, we're kind of always looking to the next thing, but it's never like something that's so ambitious that, you know, it defeats us, that kind of feeling.
And Emily, is that the secret to it? Just taking it a day at a time. But you know, we change very much as people. We're very different today if you're over 25 than you were when you were 15. So how have you managed to maintain not only a friendship but a working relationship? Because there are frictions along the way.
There are always frictions, and we're very different people from each other. But we've known each other since elementary school. Our families live near each other. So my big sister was really like best friends with Amy's big sister in high school. Our families went through all of our milestones together. So we are anchored in our family's experiences. And then Amy and I, you know, the way that we make music and the way that we arrange music, sort of the purity of the process hasn't changed at all over all these decades, really. So, and we weren't ambitious in terms of, like Amy was saying, we took it a day at a time. So we didn't have ambition about a career. We just wanted to have fun. And we have a deep respect for each other. And I love what Amy does, separate from me, musically and as a person. And then our values are the same. You know, we knew that we wanted to link our music with social activism. And we did that from a very early age. And that has also fostered our love for the power of music. So there've been a lot of things that have anchored us. And so even interpersonal differences or spats along the way, there haven't been that many, honestly. Those are very, very small compared to the things that anchor us together in love and respect and in a very validating musical experience. And we also celebrate each other's individual endeavors.
I mentioned that there's this documentary about your careers called It's Only Life After All. Unfortunately for the people listening, for most of the people listening, they can't see it this time around because it's being screened at Davidson for students, faculty, and staff. But in that documentary, Amy, you say that the two of you were drawn together from the beginning, and in fact, when you started singing together, an explosion went off. Those are your words. And you thought, this is it. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know for Emily what happened, but for me, I was like, it was like one of those eureka moments you have. And I just, you know, discovered the power of harmony and, you know, it felt like a match musically, and I had not experienced anything like it. And I felt like it was super special. And I just had it was a change of life kind of moment where this is what I want to do. You know, I want to be in this duo and we've got something here, you know, kind of feeling. I felt.
They say that when families sing together, like families get together, have these music groups, whether it's the Carter family, the Osmond family, there's something about, I guess, the fact that they are siblings or relatives, that their voices blend really well. Is that kind of, Emily, what you experienced when you met Amy and you started singing together, that somehow there's this blend that just is magic? It works.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it like a sibling blend, because I know what you're talking about, that sort of almost like that in your DNA, what happens when you sing together, but there definitely was like a bond immediately. And then Amy and I, we love to play and listen to the same music. Amy had a lower voice, I had a higher voice. Amy was more like of a rhythm, sort of rock-centered guitar player, and I was more of a picker. And so we had these things together that worked really, really well. And all I remember, you know, like in high school is like this feeling of like, well, there's really nothing more fun than this, so let's keep doing it. So it was something that just fed itself over and over again, that we started learning more songs. And then I would say that in high school, we were best friends. Wouldn't you, Amy? Like once we
mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we were really close.
But that's been a long time, and I'm just, I guess the answer to the question, I was going to ask you how you keep it fresh after 40 years, how you find new things to sing about, how you go back and revisit your catalog of music, because people want to hear familiar songs from the two of you when you sing in concert, how you keep it fresh, and is it because you tackle issues that are important to you that keeps it that way?
I definitely think that's part of it. You know, we don't always tackle the issues in our songs, but, you know, we tackle them, if not in song, we tackle them in our practice and how we live and the activism we may do through the Indigo Girls or in our personal lives. And I think that for us, the energy of community and kind of being engaged in community and reaching into the community and kind of being part of something bigger than ourselves is, for me, energizing and sort of gives me a bigger reason to do what we do in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, the way you keep it fresh and you stay together this long is, who knows, you know, really there's like a little magic in there and luck, but also respect for each other and families that know each other and, you know, just giving each other space. And we have our own thing aside from each other. We write separately. When we're on tour, we usually take groups with us to open for us that are friends of ours. So we're enjoying the music the whole show, you know, from start to finish. And we're fans of them is that's what the truth is. It's sometimes people we know, sometimes we just meet that we're big fans of. So there's all these little things along the way that kind of make it an enriched experience. And most of them have, you know, not as much to do with ourselves and more to do with what's around us, you know, I'd say, and, you know, including our management, which we've had since we were 23, you know, and, wow. And the same booking agent as well. So
that too is remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, those things are, to me, for our, what we do, it's been fundamental to being able to stay together this long.
One thing that fascinated me when I didn't know this about the two of you, but you don't write together. You write kind of you arrange together, but you each take on different songs on your own and come together. To me, that strikes me as unusual for a duo, is it?
I don't know if it's unusual for other duos, but for us, you know, it's part of what keeps me interested in what Indigo Girls does is because I really love Amy's music and I love her songs. And I can't write songs the way Amy writes songs. I don't express myself the same way. So for me, it's like having two musical lives. I mean, I've often said and believe that I would be bored with myself if it were just me or Amy writing songs like I write. So writing songs is a very vulnerable, intimate thing, and we've both just only been able to really express ourselves individually that way. But for whatever reason, since we began, we are able to arrange the songs together. We have really good brainstorming sessions, and whoever wrote the song kind of gets the veto power in the way that, well, I don't really feel that idea. But we really just throw, there are times when we will try 16 different notes for one particular part of a phrase just to see what lands right. And then we both have sort of a sense, I say it's intrinsic or intuitive, of when the parts are really working, and then ultimately we settle on an arrangement. And that's always been the way that we've worked.
You, Emily, keep referring to Indigo Girls in the third person, like that it's this entity over
Know,
here.
isn't that weird? That's
So
so weird.
no, it's fine because each of you are individuals, and each of you have your own individual lives and careers in some cases. But where did the name come from, Indigo Girls?
Oh, it's not that exciting. It's just, when you're young, who knows what makes you think of things. But we had a gig coming up at this place called the Moonshadow Saloon, and I remember, and we were going to be coming out with a little single, and I remember I told Emily, I was like, we need like a group name because we're just using our last names. We don't sound like a band, because back then it was all about like how do you present yourself, because we were kind of part of a world that was more alternative, almost like punky, left of the dial kind of stuff. And I was like, we want to be bigger than just, as far as how we are appear as just two people playing guitar, right? So I was like, let's think of an identity sort of. And I was just looking through the dictionary for words that struck my fancy, and indigo was one of them. And I was like, oh, well, I wasn't thinking about, I think, the deeper historical ramifications of, the crops in South Carolina and its tie to, enslaved people and all those deep things that now I'm like, oh, okay. But indigo is a really beautiful plant. It's in the South. It's a dark blue kind of moody thing. And I thought, oh, that's a cool word. And then I told Emily, and Emily was like talking about alliteration and, throughout the idea of girls, indigo girls. Of course, we didn't know we'd be 60 years old talking about it, probably.
It's
So
called
that's how it worked. I mean, it was just became Indigo Girls, and you live, once you choose your name, after you've been around for a while, you don't really change it, no matter what happens.
it's called branding today.
Branding, I know,
We have one minute left in this segment. I'm just curious
cool.
as to what makes in your minds for a good Indigo Girls song, something that you want to put your stamp on. Emily.
That can change, honestly. One thing is the harmony. We're known for our harmony. We take time with our arrangements. Sometimes we take more time than others. But when we really, really take and have a lot of time, the harmonic arrangements, and then of course, lyrics are very, very important to us. So I would say a combination of thoughtful lyrics and a good vocal arrangement. Over the years, we've tried different instruments. It's nice to add some different texture as well.
That's Emily Saliers along with Amy Ray. They make up the Indigo Girls. They're in town on Friday for for a concert at Davidson College Stadium. It's open to the public. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment and also hear some of their music in case you're not familiar with them, or even if you are and you'd like to be entertained. We will make that happen for you. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Amy Ray and Emily Saliers are here. They are the Indigo Girls. They will be in town at Davidson College for a while. Why are you laughing? Davidson College.
Because I hear
My
Amy's.
dog is my dog is
Oh, okay.
looking into the window of my office and barking at me, and now I'm gonna have to like get up and let her in probably if she doesn't
All right.
stop.
Anyway,
it's hilarious.
They'll be playing today, Friday, at Davidson College Stadium, and their dog will be there too. let's talk about the in the New York Times review of the documentary film that has been made about you. The writer said that in the 80s and 90s, you were, quote, routinely mocked for being too earnest, too poetic, too folksy, too lesbian, and that back then being labeled a female gay singer-songwriter was an artistic and commercial curse. So let's unpack that. Did you feel back then that you were routinely mocked for being too earnest, too poetic, too folksy?
Yes. We were, you know.
Fair or unfair?
I think it's, listen, we are earnest. We've always been earnest. But what songwriter isn't earnest in some way? I mean, you've created the song and you're putting it out and you have an earnest intent. I think the lyrics were, granted, when we were very, very young and writing songs, there are some songs that reflect our age. But I think there was, you know, quite honestly, there existed a sexist approach to women folk singers and lesbian folk singers, forget about it, which also homophobia has its roots in sexism based on the way, you know, heteronormative and binary systems say, this is what a man is and this is what a woman is and never the twain shall meet. So there were those things, you know, we've evolved to some extent in certain places, but for us, that was very much the case. And, you know, we'd play live shows. Amy was quite adept at running live sound and always got pushback from, it was always men who ran the sound in the clubs and things like that. And we did a lot of radio morning shows and, you know, the male hosts, they didn't quite know what to do with us because they couldn't do their usual, you know, jive talk with their women artists. And so there was the reality of that. You know, back then, Ellen hadn't come out. There weren't a lot of queer mentors. So there existed those systems of, you know, just judgment. But we just stuck through. We just did, like what I said earlier, our intent for writing songs, the joy we had in music, our community was so supportive. We were able just to make it through all that. And now it's so funny and ironic to get a positive review from the New York Times, you know, back then when we would get panned by the New York Times. So things come around. We stuck with what we did. We have had joy, mostly joy, through our career. But yeah, the oppression, the judgment, and the panning and the mocking was definitely there.
So what I'm hearing you say is that things have improved, things have gotten better, things have changed for the better, because in this documentary, Amy, you say that you had never been featured at some point in your careers in the major rock press like Spin Magazine and Rolling Stone, and you say that the reason for that was your lack of radio play, but you also say it was because of the fact that you were, quote, political lesbians, your words. Is that it? Which was the worst for you, the homophobia or the sexism? Because you were not.
Well, there are so
glittery.
I mean, I think sexism is the driving force behind homophobia often. So, you know, men who are gay are mocked because they're too, you know, the stereotype is that they're too girly, which is a bad thing if you're a man, and women are mocked because they're not the proper type of woman, you know, because back then things were very narrowly defined and people thought all gay women were, you know, masculine butch women. They didn't realize that there's a, you know, a spectrum within your sexuality of also your gender presentation and how you are, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of women. There's women that are more masculine, there's women that are super feminine, and there's a lot of different kind of men too. And, you know, they're not all gay. So it's, some of that's just the sexism driving how we define, you know, gender. And some of it is homophobia. But I would say that it's, you know, it's all of a piece of a tapestry. And, you know, I think being gay was a harder thing when we were young, but even if we had been straight, we wouldn't have been the kind of women that got marketed in a certain way.
Well,
having said that, you know, I feel like you also don't know when you're young and you're the problem is that it's crazy making because you feel like, is my music not good enough? Is it because I'm gay? Is it because I'm sort of a masculine female. Like, there's no way to gauge what's happening. And so you're always questioning yourself. And that's one of the biggest problems, is that you never feel like you're standing quite on the same level ground as, you know, the gatekeepers that were at that time, mostly white men, were the ones that made the decisions, you know. And the reason it has improved, if it has at all, the improvements come through new people having power, through self-empowerment, through more DIY movements, and the internet being more wide open, and audiences being more willing to have open minds. And a lot of that is just education and youth and knowledge and things. And we evolve, you know, as humans, we evolve. There's a lot of problems, but we evolve.
But despite the fact that they couldn't put you in a box, they couldn't categorize you, you weren't the sparkly, sequined, adorned duo, you were something else, and you didn't get a lot of radio airplay, at least in the beginning, and you didn't make the rock and roll press a lot, at least in the beginning, you succeeded, you persevered, you are major successful. How do you explain that, despite all of those obstacles?
I mean, we have a community that relates to our songs, takes our music with them. We've always had a community. You know, even at the beginning when there were four people in the audience and there were Amy's parents and my parents, there was support. And we have stuck to our values. There's never been any inclination whatsoever to compromise what we want to do artistically or otherwise, politically, socially. So, and along the way, there was so much joy, like Amy was saying, who we played with, who joined us on, you know, we played Little Five Points Pub in Atlanta. What a motley crew of friends and community members who joined us on stage. So we always had the expression of music as like, this is community, this is joyful, this is powerful, this is cathartic. And all along the way, as we just tried to play the next gig, it became a career. And, you know, there were times where we could draw a larger audience, and now we draw a smaller audience than that, but it just doesn't matter because everything has felt in the moment, community supported, and we just stuck to the thing that we do, and we never altered from that.
You've championed a lot of different causes, the environment, the rights of Native Americans. You advocated for the abolition of the death penalty. Obviously, your icons in the LGBTQ movement, and your efforts in that movement gave a lot of people hope and comfort. And some of them spoke about that in this documentary about your career called It's Only Life After All. And here's what a few of them had to say.
I came out in 1997, and their music helped me deal with that fact.
Discovered them when I was coming out, just to know that there was people out there who were saying the things that you were feeling.
We spent a lot of good times rocking out to the Indigo Girls and getting married to the Indigo
yes.
Girls, so we love you girls for that.
Yes.
We're going 24 years strong, so.
I've been clean and sober 29 years now. They were almost like this unspoken permission that it was okay to like let all that go, and a lot of healing went on. Probably the second third of my growing up, and I think I'm just on the last third now, so funny.
I went through a divorce 10 years ago, and I like would blare the Indigo Girls on Saturdays when I didn't have my kid with me, and you know, it's at times it's helped me survive and made it so that I stayed here and didn't check out. And that's been true over the course of, you know, the 30 plus years I've been listening to them.
Comments like those must be incredibly gratifying, especially that last one, because she credits you and your music essentially with saving her life. Amy, do you understand? Is it possible for the two of you to understand the power that your music apparently has for people?
Well, no. I mean, those it's because I think it's bigger than the music. I think it has to do with people coming together. And in that moment, they're together, you know, and that togetherness can heal. And I think when you listen to the music, you know, if you've been at shows, you associate that feel, you know. I'm not sure if people could, maybe people could experience the same thing just listening to a record, but and through the lyrics maybe, and just they can feel, you know, the humanity in it. But I think part of part of that is also just when you go to a show, everything, you know, politics, gender, sexuality, race, class, it's all shoved aside, hopefully, and your humanity is what's important. So, and we really believe that, and hopefully our music reflects that when you're even just listening to it on a record or something. But we've never understood when people tell us that. It's very moving. It's not even just like gratifying, it's just like moving. Like, what do you do with that? You know, you're thankful for it, and you are really thankful for them having their life and moving on and being able to live. You know, it feels good when someone says, I could have checked out, but I'm alive. That's, you know, that's a validation for us too. Like, we, at any moment that we're depressed and or we feel really just inconsolable in life, knowing, having experienced other people go through things and be strong, it helps us. You know, they're not audience members, they're people, you know, yeah. And we hear from them and we hear their statements, and it's amazing.
That's certainly a component of what I'm going to ask you about next, Emily, but it's not the whole thing, because you have become cultural icons as well as icons in the LGBTQ community and Native Americans and other organizations that you have supported, because you have been the answer to a New York Times crossword puzzle. You're mentioned a number of times in a Stephen King novel. You've been name-dropped on TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Will and Grace, South Park, 30 Rock, The Office, even Nip Tuck, which I think is interesting. That's kind of a niche show that I watched 100 years ago. Do you have an explanation for that, how you became this touchstone in American culture?
Well, I think you have to look at the number of years we've been at it. So if you add up the number of years and you count the number of, you know, mentions, it kind of puts things in perspective and balance. But, and you know, personally, well, because we both love crosswords, to get in the crossword is a very, very big deal.
Did you get the answer right? Did you know the answer?
Yeah, typically, yes. And I just say, well, thank goodness for the right, you know, the right combination of letters that fits in a crossword. Because they certainly don't start out constructing the puzzle going, I'm going to put Indigo Girls in here.
Did you know that you would be in a puzzle, or did you just discover it somehow?
No. That's why we never know any of this stuff. Like, even with Barbie, the movie Barbie, when we heard we were going to be in the trailer for the movie, we didn't know we were going to be in the movie. It's just like this constant, like, surprises and really fun things. I don't know if I don't know how we get mentioned in these programs. A lot of times it's, you know, it's a joke about being earnest lesbians, and that's how we got mentioned. But there's plenty of other where it's just like, well, here's a little bit of credence to the Indigo Girls. Oh, there I go again in third person. I don't know why I'm doing that.
That's okay. You brought up Barbie, and I'm glad you did, because you were in this blockbuster movie last summer that Greta Gerwig put together with Margot Robbie, and in that movie, Margot Robbie is on a road trip in her cute little car, trying to go off on a journey to discover who and what she is and who and what she could be. And she finds herself singing one of your songs.
I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source from some definitive, closer I am to find.
Closer I am to find. What are you doing here?
I'm coming with you.
Please get out.
Well, I was going to ask what your reaction was, but I just got it. you weren't told that you weren't asked for permission to license that for the movie? You didn't know it was coming?
No, we knew knew it was being licensed, but we didn't know it was going to be in the movie. We definitely knew it was going to be in the trailer. We just didn't know anything more. They didn't send us like a pre-release of Barbie to check it out. You know, it was all under wraps. It was so exciting.
So it was kind of like, we want to use this song in the trailer, but we're not sure it's going to make the cut for the movie yet. And that was kind of like, how would that be? But that's fine. And then, you know, because we knew it was Greta Gerwig, who we adore. And then, you know, we, and then they were like, well, it's going to be in the movie. So, but we didn't know until we went to the theater. Yeah. Oh, it's function. It's like a functional part of the plot.
So what
which
do you
is
think
so
of her,
cool.
What do you think of Margot singing? Is she going to be the third Indigo girl now?
Well, that's what I love about it. It sounds like a friend in a car just singing slightly off tune. No offense, Margot. it just sounds like, you know, a hootenanny in a car, and that's what makes it perfect.
What if anything, did that song do for you? The fact that it was in that movie, did it lead to any renaissance or any tick up in sales of that album that that song came from? I think it was on your second album, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, Spotify listening went up, different, you know, streaming services that we could trace that the listeners went up for a while. And then I think there was a resurgence of energy and interest around our music. And you sort of felt that in some of the shows I did. I can't speak for Amy, but just there's been a bit of a resurgence with the documentary and with Barbie and with the movie Glitter and Doom. It's just sort of like a convergence and a confluence of these good things that happen. So I would say there definitely was an effect. And the other night we were playing somewhere. I saw this little girl, maybe 8 or 9, singing every word to the songs. And it just gave me the best feeling ever in the world to know that a little girl was singing the songs.
You know, I've talked to a lot of performers and singers who have hits. And of course, if you have a hit, you are compelled to sing it every time you do a live concert. And sometimes those singers are so tired of those songs, but they have to kind of do it because that's what's expected of them. Although I did go to a Seals and Crofts concert once where they said, we're not going to play any of our hits. We're going to play all the album tracks that we like. And the crowd turned hostile, quite honestly. but I've also watched artists who record these things and they hear me play them back and they don't like listening to them. I have 30 seconds. Do you mind hearing yourself?
No, we don't mind.
It's okay.
Okay, because when we come back, we're going to hear you. Okay. We're going to hear the real recording of Closer to Fine that Margot Robbie sang over a moment ago, among other songs from our guest this hour, the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emmy Saliers, there at Davidson College Stadium on Friday night for their Look Long concert tour. I think I got that backwards. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, our guest, the Indigo Girls, and here's the real version of Closer to Fine.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me used to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable. And lightness has a call that's hard to hear. I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Closer I am to find. Closer I am to find. Yeah.
Closer to Find, the Indigo Girls, our guest today. There's a line in that song, which has become the title of the documentary film that they're screening for the students, faculty, and staff at Davidson this week. It's only life after all. What's the message there?
Well, you know, every time I sing that line, I sort of feel like, but wait, it's not just it's only life after all, because of course, life is a gift. And so I feel two things at the same time. When I wrote the song, Closer to Fine is about why I draw wisdom and solace from this thing, whether it's the mountains or the children or whatever. And so it's like this sort of like, I'll learn from this, I'll learn from this, I'll learn from this. And then that line is just like, okay, just relax. It's only life after all. So it's a bit of, it's not tongue in cheek, but it's meant to be a bit slightly humorous. But when I do sing the song, I don't feel like literally, oh, well, it's only life after all. So it's a bit of a combo platter there.
In what I think believe is your latest album, Look Long, Emily, you wrote the title song in which you sing about a lost form of American identity. Play the record, please. Lost form of American identity, the current political climate, and say that we all sense Armageddon. Can we hear a bit of that, please? Emily, you wrote that song, and you sing about your grandfather's telescope. We just heard those lyrics. Later on, you sing about how your grandmother had Apollo mission glasses etched in red, white, and blue, and you sing that you're no AWOL patriot because you've dodged party lines, and say that you will always love your troubled nation. What are your views on the political climate that we're living through right now, and in which we are told that democracy is threatened?
Oh, that is, I'm going to try to make this a short answer to that, because really we cannot separate how we understand things in this country without taking into account the propaganda over the years that we've been taught about how government works. And we sort of have this American idealized version of democracy. And, you know, when you look into the dark forces of how power and money intertwine, it's complicated, and it's not that patriotic message that we were taught in school and growing up. You know, I think our political situation is chaotic. I think that elections are really whoever, for the most part, whoever has the most money wins. And I also think that the dangerous thing now is that a different truths, there's no such thing as truth anymore. Is this true or is this not true? And, you know, I believe in relativism, of course, but it's very dangerous to promote lies and have people believe them as truths. It's a complicated situation. What this song really speaks to is perspective, long-term vision and short-term vision. So using the magnifying glass to burn grass is the short-term vision, and the telescope with the cosmos and taking in our relationship and size to everything else is the long-term vision. And in the end, even though, you know, there are political social beliefs that I'm adamantly opposed to, I think we have to find some way to connect as people, not only in this nation, but across the world, where we can see our common humanity. And I really mean that, because there are always going to be differences. We're going to be fraught with violence and oppression and suffering. It's just part of human reality. But as human beings, we do have this capacity to work towards recognizing a common humanity. And I think that's going to be the key.
Well, there are a lot of lyrics in that song that stood out to me. But one, one that jumped out at me was the one, the very last set of lyrics that we heard. Look home, look home, look home. What are you saying there?
Well, it says look long, which is...
Oh, I'm sorry.
So look long, look long, look long is really, let's keep the long-term vision for the world we can create in mind rather than the short-term vision.
That's a political song. And I'm just curious, Amy, since Emily wrote it, had you not been on a similar or same page, and maybe you aren't, does it matter? Are there topics that one or the other of you bring to the table that one or the other of you may not be on the same page about? Do you still then arrange it and perform it?
Well, if it was something really, you know, that we really didn't agree about, like in a fundamental way, I think either one of us would know not to bring it into the duo to begin with, because we're smart that way and we know each other well. But no, I mean, we have the same, you know, broad values, and we'll voice things in different ways often, and we'll have the different way sometimes that we think we need to get to where we're going and things like that. But no, I mean, I think that song in particular is a very astute and powerful song. And you know, normally the thing that happens is that we're like, you know, really, you know, studying each other's songs and being happy about the lyrics and respectful and compelled by them, you know, and what they're saying, because we do share a lot of perspective and values, and obviously because we do activism together, and you know, and but we believe that it's important to have little differences and, you know, respect them and stuff like that. I mean, typically we know each other well enough now that if there was a song that I'd be like, oh, I don't know if Emily's gonna be able to sing that, I probably wouldn't bring it into the fold, and vice versa. But we're really honest with each other. I mean, if there was something we couldn't sing, we wouldn't do it. It would be fine.
And I ask that because we're at this moment where the political divide is so very severe. It splits families with long-term relationships, and you certainly are a family with a long-term relationship. And I'm just curious whether that might have been impacting you. We have an email from a listener who writes something really nice. When I first heard you sing in 1989, they say, I was blown away. That's all in caps. Year over year, your music has brought me joy and peace, and now my daughters, who are 15 and 9, are huge fans too. I see your music has the same effect on them, and I am eternally grateful to you for that. On any given afternoon after school, you'll hear us serenading the folks at Ben and Jerry's in Davidson because your songs are on a frequent playlist there. There you go.
I mean, anything that makes you sing out loud at an ice cream store, that's good. That's good.
You tackle a lot of different themes aside from politics, and you sing about gun violence, you've sung about gender identity, and then there's one that you wrote, Amy, that just seems, to me, wistful and happy. Kansas City Girl. Oh. I love that song. I can't explain it. It just gets under your skin, and you want to jump up and down while you're hearing it. What's it about for you?
An ode to rideshare and taxi cabs. I mean, I was just thinking about how we get in these cars off, you know, with people that we don't know, and drive around, and they rescue us from wherever we are and wherever we need to go. And you don't really have a comp. I mean, sometimes you talk, especially if it's a taxi, you know, Uber and Lyft are a little bit different sometimes, right. But you don't know each other and you're riding together and there's all this intimacy of riding in the same car together, you know,
right.
Yet you don't really know each other. And I always wonder, like, who is this person and what they're about? And often if they're playing the radio, you can kind of get a glimpse into their life of what they choose to play, you know? So it's just about that. It's just a fun,
she wasn't
a fun
playing
song.
You, was she? And she wasn't playing your songs, was she?
No, she was literally playing hip hop radio station.
Yeah. in the course of viewing some of the documentary about you yesterday, I discovered that, Amy, you are kind of the keeper of the Indigo Girls archive, that you have all kinds of memorabilia stashed away in places, including a gold record, which I found interesting. It wasn't on the wall. It was stashed away in some corner someplace. And you have all these posters and tapes and did you know when you set out, were you collecting this just because it was like, I want to be able to remember this in my dotage, or did you see something big coming and you could be the official archivist?
I did not see anything big coming. I just believe in archiving. My dad was a very you know, enthusiastic archiver of our life and his life and my mom's life, and just always a bit of a hoarder, probably, I guess, is the other way to say it, but which I am too. I just love archives. I love archives. I love history. So I thought, okay, every time we did something, I was like, oh, this is cool. I want to save this because later I want to look back on it. I wasn't foreseeing anything, any use of it, really. I just like having it.
Not only is there a documentary about the two of you, but your music is being used as the soundtrack to a new jukebox musical romance movie called Glitter and Doom, in which you both make appearances. Here's a bit of a scene between Amy and one of the film's romantic leads who has music dreams.
I don't know when I noticed after life my expense. The words of my heart lined up like prisoners on a fence. Dreams came in like needy children tugging at my sleep. Said I am no way of feeding you solely.
Sorry.
Well, that melody's magic, but ever think about clicking down the BPMs and, you know, chilling the tone out a little bit? Shite. Dreams came in like needy children tugging at my sleeve. I said I have no way of feeding you solely. See, it makes you want to lean in and, you know, like, check what you're trying to tell us about your life.
Amy Ray as mentor.
not an Oscar-winning performance.
But I was going to ask the two, because you're both in this, what was acting like?
Admittedly, I'm not an actor. I kept telling them, don't expect anything. I'll do this because it's all for fun. You know, Emily's like more of an actor than me. But it was really fun, like a super fun experience. And I tried really hard. So I'll give you that.
I thought it was just fun. I think you did what was called for. I thought it was just fun. What's the plot of the movie?
It's a love story.
Yeah, it's a love story. It's written by Corey Krokeberg and Tom Gustafson, his partner, directed it. It's a love story between two different personalities. They're both artists, and the struggles that keep them from pursuing their dream. And then finally, they have to be apart in order to make their dream sort of come to reality. And it's a love story. And it's quite an honor to have them use our music. Michelle Shamuel did all the musical arrangements and production, and she did a fantastic job, and we love the film.
We have 30 seconds left. It was 35 years ago that you first played Davidson College to what the college newspaper back then described as an easily sold-out show with hundreds of screaming fans. What reaction do you anticipate this Friday at Davidson?
It'll be so good to be back.
Yeah, it's right down the road, you know, and
right.
I expect we'll have a lot of sentimental feelings, and my brother's going to text me the whole time, probably.
Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, the Indigo Girls, they'll be doing their Look Long concert tour at Davidson College Stadium this Friday. Thank you for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.